Today on Annenberg Radio News.
You actually feel like everybody is just as passionate about, you know, changing the world like you are.
We see the world through the eyes of a study abroad student turned global activist. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to Annenberg Radio News for Tuesday, March 27th, 2012. I'm Emily Frost. Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa went to LAX today for the unveiling of the new Alaska Airlines terminal. As Devin Altschul reports, the PR event was interrupted by protesters.
The news conference set to unveil Alaska Airlines' new terminal was interrupted before it even started. A group of airport employees chanting in Spanish and English protested against the private contractor, Aviation Safeguards, for alleged poor working conditions.
Mayor, escucha, estamos en la lucha.
Mayor Villaraigosa did not let the protest damper the unveiling of what is being called the Airport of the Future. He led all the reporters away from the protesters, through security, and into the new terminal for a tour. When you first arrive at the terminal, there is not a long winding line of travelers checking bags at one ticket counter. Instead, there are 12 stations to weigh and check bags and more security lanes to get travelers to their gates fast. Nicholas Dalton, who was traveling this morning, was surprised at how quickly he got to his gate.
I definitely thought it was a very fast procedure. It was like 5 minutes in and out.
At the new gates, passengers no longer have to search for plugs to keep electronics alive. 50% of seats in the waiting room areas are equipped with electrical power. Since Alaska also operates the most international flights out of LAX daily, it created a glass corridor to take passengers directly to customs without having to leave the terminal. Even the restaurants in the terminal are popular places that can be found around the city.
You're going to see concessions that reflect LA, the diversity of LA, the flavor of LA. You're going to see the concessions throughout the airport doing that.
The new terminal was completed on time and $33 million under budget. It cost $238 million and opened for business last week. Traveler Brittany Holland says she already sees a difference.
Alaska was like, get checkpoint, go. We're already here and we're sitting here waiting, so no, not really a lot of hassle.
This new terminal of the future still has a few projects to finish, but is on path to eventually regain a reputation as the West Coast's dominant international gateway. Devin Altschul, Annenberg Radio News.
Presidential candidate Mitt Romney is in California on a two-day fundraising trip that started in San Diego yesterday. Today, he's in Los Angeles. He's scheduled to appear on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and he's at a fundraising event in Century City. That's where several protests are happening at this hour, focusing on Romney's wealth and his positions on key issues of concern to California voters. Veronica Villafañe has the story.
Mitt Romney began his Los Angeles area fundraising in Irvine with a $1,000 a plate lunch where donors paid an additional $1,500 to get a photo with a Republican presidential hopeful. But many Angelenos aren't rolling out the welcome mat for Mitt. Labor leaders, immigration activists, and a coalition of the 99% are organizing three different protests outside a Romney fundraiser in Century City this evening.
And mostly we're sending a message to voters out there that Mitt Romney really is the candidate of the 1%, representing not just millionaires, but a corporate culture that really crashed our economy.
Jacob Hay with Good Jobs LA is part of the coalition of the 99%, which has been advocating for jobs, against foreclosures, and access to health care.
Well, we'll certainly be able to get his attention, whether he listens or not. That remains to be seen. He does have a history of changing his position, so maybe he is persuadable.
That's what Pedro Ramirez hopes for. He's an organizer for a coalition of undocumented students. They're known as Dreamers because they came as children to the U.S. and dream of being legal citizens of the only country they know. And they're targeting Latino voters.
For Dreamers, although we can't vote, we can organize, we can engage our communities, and we're going to educate them on the issues, not on the candidates, but on the issues. And they're going to be selecting the candidates. And so their vote is our voice, and our voice is their vote.
Latino activists believe their vote will be a deciding factor in the 2012 elections. For Annenberg Radio News, I'm Veronica Villafañe.
California has gone blue in every presidential election since 1988, when George Bush Sr. was elected. Party nominations are usually wrapped up before the California primary. But this year, political analyst Brett Tetlow predicts the Golden State will play a major role in choosing the Republican candidate.
California and Texas could be the deciding final sort of main states. Santorum is a virtual unknown to California voters. So Mitt's got a big lead. I think it's kind of a soft lead. I think it's probably just name ID right now at this point.
Tetlow says Romney's advantage in California could translate to a big win nationwide, as long as Santorum doesn't eat into his support before California's June 5th primary. The L.A. County Board of Supervisors listened to Sheriff Lee Baca discuss the progress he's made in improving his department and the jail system. The improvements were recommended by the Office of Independent Review after an L.A. Times investigation exposed misconduct in the jails. Andrea Kowalczyk reports.
Liability was the word of the day for the L.A. County Board of Supervisors. Sheriff Lee Baca defended his department during the contentious meeting. Supervisor Gloria Molina acted as the force behind the attack. She worried that unclear guidelines could leave the county open to lawsuits. The ACLU recently sued the sheriff's department for violating human rights in the jail system. The fight during the meeting came down to the use of directives versus policies. Sheriff Baca contends that there isn't a difference.
Well, by our standards and by the common professional standards of the word directive or policy, they're one and the same. Directives are policies. In fact, in case law, which is something I'm a little familiar with, the fact that we don't do something, let's just say nothing is written, can be interpreted in a court as policy.
Molina didn't buy it and consulted County Counsel John Cratley.
Is that the case?
I'd want to consider that further.
I would think so. I think a good lawyer is going to pull out that there's a difference between a directive and a policy.
Supervisor Molina also reprimanded the sheriff for claiming the use of force has decreased in the jails. Molina admits to a countywide decrease, but she says it's actually doubled at the Men's Central Jail.
Again, I think the issue for us is trying to get a recognition when you make statements like we've had a decrease in use of force, and we look at the numbers in December, January, and February of this year, they don't show a decrease.
The sheriff's department has planned for the use of 705 new cameras in both Men's Central Jail and the Twin Towers facility in order to decrease its liability. But the jail's computer network needs a $2.5 million upgrade first. Project leader Mario Mejica says the network needs to increase 10 times what it is now.
And basically what that means is if your highway, you're coming across the 5, 10, and 60 and you're just jammed. Basically what we have to do is we have to increase that highway.
The upgrade is expected to be complete at Men's Central Jail by May, with Twin Towers following in July. Today's meeting only covered three of the recommendations made by Special Counsel Merrick Bobb. The board and the sheriff will meet again in the future to discuss them further. Andrea Kowalczyk, Annenberg Radio News.
In its second day before the Supreme Court, President Obama's health care law faced tough questioning from the court's conservative justices. Logan Healy reports.
Just minutes into today's arguments, four of the court's conservative judges posed skeptical questions to the lawyer defending the health law. Most analysts believe one of those four justices could be the vote needed to uphold the law, but today's questioning indicated an uphill battle for the law's supporters. Defenders say the law falls within Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce because all Americans are virtually certain to use health insurance sometime in their lives. But opponents argue it steps beyond the Constitution and sets a dangerous precedent. The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is President Obama's most important and controversial domestic policy. It has been a rallying cry for Tea Party conservatives demanding a smaller federal government. In the 2010 midterm elections, Republicans used opposition to the law to win their most commanding control of the House of Representatives since 1949. According to a recent New York Times CBS poll, 51% of Americans oppose the individual mandate, compared to 45% who support it. But the same poll also found Americans strongly support most of the law's other provisions. Two of the most popular would require insurance companies to cover pre-existing medical conditions without a penalty, and allow young adults to remain on their parents' health insurance until they're 26. Legal analysts and blogs say it's almost impossible to determine how the court will ultimately rule on the case, but the decision will be very close either way. Logan Healy, Annenberg Radio News.
And now for the weather. Tonight we'll have mostly clear skies with a low of 50, a few clouds and a slight chance of light showers tomorrow, a high of 67 and a low of 52. Those clouds will continue into Thursday. Expect highs just below 70. Later on Annenberg Radio News, we talk with a Mexican-American who says you can ask him anything, no matter how un-PC it sounds. California hosts more international students than any other state. For our series 20-something, Megan Suisse profiles a Nigerian student who has already been tapped for global leadership.
A call to prayer rings out from her cell phone. The young Muslim is bowing to the ground, Mecca in the distance, the white wall of her Moreno Valley tract home immediately in front of her. When 26-year-old Azra Bada first came to the United States in 2002, her life was set out for her. But, she says, God had different plans.
I used to say when I first came to America, I'm gonna get my degree, then like I said, I was really gonna be a doctor and then go back home, you know?
Home was Lagos, Nigeria. Like many African parents with the means to do so, hers sent Azra, the youngest of nine, to study abroad.
I got on a plane at 17. I was coming to the U.S. I've never been on a plane or anything, and I can't believe my parents let me, but they did.
First came a degree in nursing, then public health. The next step was to be med school, but Azra didn't get that far. Instead, she clicked on a Facebook posting about a program called One Young World.
The idea was to bring together all these fabulous young people who had great ideas, you know, and finding solutions to kind of the problems happening in the world. There was going to be Kofi Annan and Desmond Tutu, all these famous people were going to be there.
She applied, and in February 2010, Azra found herself in London with nearly 1,000 other young leaders.
One world.
One world.
One people.
One people.
One of the discussions was, so what are we going to do now that we feel all empowered? You know, like you go to a room, I don't know if you've ever felt it, but a room where you actually feel like everybody is just as passionate about, you know, changing the world like you are.
Let us begin.
I literally couldn't sleep after the summit.
In her sleepless nights, she had a realization. Her colleagues talked a lot about interfaith dialogue, but it was missing from the UN's discussion of development. She emailed her new friends and the idea caught on. Soon the idea became an initiative, and the initiative became a campaign. There's a website, t-shirt, flyers, an online commercial featuring Azra.
At this time, we're working on a platform to bring together the most influential representatives from the fields of business.
At the London Summit in 2010, Azra was in awe of the social justice celebs she saw. Now in Zurich, she and her project partners were attracting the attention. Desmond Tutu approached her backstage.
He just signed my petition for the Missing Millennium Development Goal on stage. I mean, that was amazing. So he just comes in, he just finds me, and he, you know, gives me this handshake and gives me a pat on my back, and, you know, he's just so nice.
It's an incredible privilege to be here with you.
I love having them listen to you and engage with you. Just gave you that kind of, you know, very kind of oomph. Oh,
okay. Back in California, Azra stays connected to her new global network through Skype. One moment, the One Young World office checks in from London about another global campaign.
We are over 25,000 and 83 countries.
A few minutes later, Azra discusses strategy with a colleague in Argentina.
I think it's important to stay grounded.
I think you should send an email with like those exact words.
Changing the world is slow, frustrating work. Azra hopes to find a PhD program that will allow her to develop her interfaith initiative. Before then, she wants to work. The only problem? Her student visa expires in April, and she needs a company to sponsor her in the U.S. This global activist would love to stay in California, but she might have to find a new home.
There comes a point in your life, even from a religious perspective, of when you must follow your passion and your purpose. I think it'll be a little bit tough to go start up somewhere else, but then again, I'm more interested in my purpose, and if it isn't somewhere else, then I want to be there just as soon as possible.
Azra knows something will work out. After all, she says, God is in charge. Megan Suisse, Annenberg Radio News.
The case of Trayvon Martin is still reverberating nationally, and here in L.A., he's the 17-year-old killed by a neighborhood watch volunteer in Sanford, Florida. As Tricia Tongo reports, outraged community members rallied in South Los Angeles today to call for the arrest of George Zimmerman.
Dozens of people lined the street outside of the Los Angeles Sentinel in South L.A. Danny Bakewell, the publisher of the traditionally black newspaper, called for Zimmerman's arrest so the trial could take place in the court, not the media.
I even have on one today with a hood on it. I just came from exercise class. You can't go around shooting someone because they look suspicious.
When Martin was shot, he was unarmed, only holding Skittles and an iced tea, a fact that led many to question his alleged role as aggressor. To make a point, a man threw a bucket of Skittles into the air.
Skittles has never killed anybody. Is that right? I'm still standing.
Another point of contention was that Martin's hooded sweatshirt made him responsible for his own death.
All of our children wear hoodies. Many of the parents wear hoodies. None of that is a justification or a provocation for allowing someone's life to be taken from them.
During the autopsy, police tested Martin for drugs and alcohol. The teenager had been suspended from school for drug possession. One big criticism is that the victim is on trial, while the public knows little about the investigation into Zimmerman, the man who shot him. For Annenberg Radio News, this is Tricia Tonko.
Gustavo Arellano's Ask a Mexican column for the OC Weekly is wildly popular with millions of readers across the country. The column combines humor and real advice and digs into readers' most outrageous questions about Mexicans in America. I asked Arellano why Ask a Mexican became so successful after starting as a one-time spoof.
When it comes to the issue of immigration, specifically Mexican immigration in the United States, you frequently get either a tired and true story about, oh, Mexicans are saints or they're people and no human being is illegal, or you get the opposite, they're all a bunch of aliens, blah, 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 blah. My column mocks both of those. And frankly, my column also answers whatever questions people may have. It's a cliche to say, but people, I do believe, were taken aback and enjoyed. They found it refreshing that somebody would actually answer these questions so bluntly and with the truth and with humor or attempts at humor. I can never say that I'm actually humorous, but you know, with attempts at humor. And from there, I wouldn't say so much the column is popular as it is notorious. Most people like it. Most people hate it. But even if those people hate it, they're still reading it.
Have the questions changed over the years? Are people becoming more educated?
The questions are always going to veer wildly all over the map. From the very beginning, some questions were just amazing in their level of understanding, like really in-depth questions, military strategies during the Mexican War, the War of Independence and the Mexican Revolution. Like these are serious students of Mexican history to, oh geez, there was a question a couple of weeks ago. I'm a Mexican-American and I'm annoyed that my Mexican neighbor picks through our trash in our apartments to look for cans. Why do Mexicans pick through trash? That was so ignorant that, you know, especially coming from a Mexican-American. You might expect this from somebody who is not Mexican, so this person should know better. And that's what's great about doing the column is that they've always veered wildly.
And you have a new book coming up. It's called Taco USA, How Mexican Food Conquered America. And you've said that there are gross inadequacies in Americans' understanding of Mexican food. What are those? And what was your inspiration for this book?
When it comes to Mexican food, people in the United States, for the most part, they think of the Mexican food that's in their region. And for the most part, it's still going to be a combination of Tex-Mex and Cal-Mex platters, which is to say the combo plate, everything covered in yellow cheese, hard shell tacos, margaritas being the only Mexican drink, nor horchata or jamaica or tamarindo. In that sense, Americans still don't really realize the breadth of Mexican food, not only from Mexico, but Mexican food in the United States. The way somebody in San Antonio eats is going to be different from the way someone in El Paso eats, which is going to be completely different from how we here in Southern California eat.
I've been speaking with Gustavo Arellano. For a longer version of our interview, go to our website. And that's it for today. Thank you for joining us. As always, for more info, go to our website, annenbergradio.org.